for federal
this
news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a law firm located in Reston, Virginia, but serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com or give us a call for an appointment at 703-218-2100. Also, I invite you to read my blog or listen to the blog or watch the blog at blueprintforwealth.org, where you can find videos, audio, and articles of interest on tax planning, estate planning, and business planning. And lastly, I invite you to read my column in the Washington Business Journal every month entitled Blueprint for Wealth. Today, we're going to be talking about expatriation. Has the passage of Obamacare left you like conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh threatening to leave the country? Have the elections left you in a funk? Or perhaps you're sick of listening to Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and the Tea Partiers, and you'd like to flee to a remote island without cable or satellite TV? Or maybe you're a naturalized U.S. citizen or a permanent resident holding a green card who's prospered here but would now like to move back to the old country for retirement. Whatever your motive is, just because you leave the U.S. and you renounce your citizenship or turn in your green card, don't assume you can leave U.S. taxes or tax forms, for that matter, behind, particularly if you're well off. If you expatriate, and that means renouncing your citizenship or your green card status, after 2008, which is today, then certain expatriation tax rules apply to you. For those who expatriate now, since Internal Revenue Code Section 877 capital A applies, you're subject to an immediate excise tax, which deems you, for tax purposes, to have sold all of your worldwide property for fair market value the day before you depart the United States. It wasn't always this way. Way back in the 1960s, you could leave the U.S. permanently without worrying about taxes. In 1966, Congress and the President passed its first major tax initiative to seek revenue from those who were leaving for tax avoidance purposes. In 1994, a Forbes cover story described how wealthy Americans such as Campbell Soup heir John Dorrance III, the late Carnival founder Ted Arison, and Dart Container heir Kenneth Dart gave up their U.S. citizenship and avoided U.S. income tax or estate tax despite these rules. So changes were made to the law then, and again in 2004, and again in 2008. The first thing you need to know about the United States is that Uncle Sam taxes income worldwide. The U.S. is unusual in that respect. It asserts the right to tax your worldwide income and at death your assets of citizens and those who are permanent residents of the U.S. It doesn't matter where you live, where the income is earned, or where else you might pay tax. Yes, you may receive foreign tax credits for taxes that you pay to other jurisdictions outside the United States, but it may offset some of your taxes, but not all of your taxes. The key point is that if you're a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, no matter where you go, Uncle Sam asserts a claim on your wealth. So being a permanent resident or U.S. citizen can be very expensive. Next, expatriation means that you're really leaving the country. To even think about putting yourself beyond the reach of the IRS, a citizen must give up your U.S. citizenship, and in the case of citizens subject to the Internal Revenue Code, severely limit the time spent in the U.S. to not more than a certain amount of time. Now, you may think that no one has ever done this, but many have. Permanent U.S. residents, those people who are holding green cards, also pay U.S. tax on worldwide income. And so they may find it easier to take advantage of the expatriation route, particularly if family or business opportunities beckon back in their country of origin. Next, there is no longer a 10-year window in which you have to pay tax. The exit tax is imposed on the date before you depart the United States. If you don't pay it, then the IRS will come after you. Now, there are ways of deferring the tax if you post a security bond in accordance with the Internal Revenue Code. But the bottom line is the tax is due before you leave. Now, there are some big changes that were enacted in 1996, but since 1996 and in 2004 in particular, it used to be that tax avoidance was relevant. Now, it doesn't matter if you have a tax avoidance motive. In 2004, in the American Jobs Creation Act, Congress threw out the tax avoidance motive test altogether. There would be 10 years of U.S. tax on U.S. source gross income under the 2004 law. Now, the law, again, imposes the excise tax if you leave after 2008 if you meet certain tests. The first test is if your income tax, your net annual average income tax over the last 5 years, is equal to or greater than $151,000 for 2012, then you will be subject to the excise tax. If you don't meet that test, but you have a net worth of at least $2 million on the date of expatriation, and that, again, is worldwide assets, then you will be subject to the 877A exit tax. There are certain other tests, but even if you're below the thresholds that I just mentioned, you'll get taxed. For example, expatriates must certify their past U.S. tax compliance by filing IRS Form 8854. Any expatriate who fails to certify compliance with U.S. federal income tax laws for the 5 years preceding expatriation is subject to the exit tax, even though they didn't meet the income tax threshold or the net worth threshold. Next, there are special rules for certain long-term residents. It's easy to define who is or is not a U.S. citizen, but the term long-term resident isn't quite as clear. A long-term resident is a non-U.S. citizen who is a lawful permanent resident of the United States in at least 8 years during the 15-year period before ending the U.S. residency. It includes green card holders. A person is not treated as a lawful permanent resident for purposes of the 8-year test in a year in which that person is a resident of a foreign country under a tax treaty and takes advantage of the treaty benefits. Holding a green card, by the way, for at least 1 day in any taxable year taints the whole year for purposes of this 8-year, 15-year test. Now, there's this exit tax that I mentioned. The HEROES Earnings Assistance and Tax Relief Act of 2008, also known as the HEROES Act, or also the acronym for the legislation is also known as HART, changed the method of taxation for those who become expatriates on or after June 17th of 2008. It added a bunch more complexity. But the bottom line is the exit tax is applied if you meet these tests. Now, there is an exclusion that you can avoid the exit tax if your assets are above a certain level, but the gain on the sale of those assets is not. The exit tax has broad application, but if you have less than $651,000 of income from the deemed sale of your assets, that's for 2012, then you pay no taxes. The exemption amount is indexed for inflation as years pass. Fortunately, not all expatriates face the exit tax. Only covered expatriates do. Under prior law, you generally had to give notice when you were expatriating to trigger the rules. Now, if you relinquish your green card or your passport, it's generally automatic. But some expatriates, even under the new law, can escape the tax. The financial thresholds that I just described, the $2 million or the income tax thresholds, can still exempt you. Also, some people who were born into dual citizenship, who haven't had a substantial presence in the U.S., and certain minors who are under the age of 18 and a half are exempt from this exit tax. You still have to file Form 8854 with the Internal Revenue Service. You can also elect to defer the tax, as I mentioned earlier, by posting adequate security. The rules are complex, and they basically subject you to having to post a security bond with assets that you already have so that the IRS can collect the tax if you flee. As you might expect, there are forms to file and procedures to follow if you desire to expatriate. In fact, if you're wavering, the paperwork alone may keep you stateside. You must file IRS Form 8854, in some cases, for 10 years for each year after you expatriate. Additional special forms, including Form W8CE and other forms, are also required. There's an IRS notice that's a good source of information on this topic. It's IRS Notice 2009-85, which is still effective today. The bottom line is, get some professional help from a lawyer and an accountant who have experience in dealing with this expatriation. As we're just merely scratching the surface of this area, the tax rules regarding expatriation for citizens and green card holders are very complex, perhaps dizzying. Gone are the days when one could renounce U.S. citizenship and start a good chance of avoiding U.S. tax. If you're facing these issues, or even if you're a beneficiary of someone else who's facing them, give us a call at Odin Feldman and Pittleman at 703-218-2100, or visit us on the web to find a lawyer that can help you at www.ofplaw.com.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Should a business use a DBA? Depending on the business marketing strategy, a business may need to use a doing business as name, also known as a DBA. For instance, a sole proprietor runs the business alone, and the business's legal name will be the sole proprietor's full name. But the proprietor may market the business's AAA appliances. In that case, the business's legal name is different than the name under which it operates and is known by the customers. The proprietor is using a DBA. A DBA is also known as a fictitious business name, and most states require that businesses register fictitious business names. Using a DBA is common practice for business. It usually is the cornerstone for marketing efforts, and some businesses may be barred by using it in some states because it may be used by other businesses. So it involves professional business entities that must be known by the names of their owners, or in other cases, using a DBA is permissible as long as it's registered. Check out our website for more information.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. With me today is my special guest, Catherine Jacquelone, the corporate nanny who's been on a couple of years ago, and we're welcoming her back for a repeat performance because she was such a good guest. Thanks for being with us, Kathy.
Nice to be here.
Since 2001, Kathy Jacquelone, president of KG Networks, which is www.kgworks.com, has managed a successful management consulting firm based in the D.C. area. Dubbed the Corporate Nanny, also www.thecorporatenanny.net, she takes a common sense approach to management and tells it like it is for businesses of all sizes. She has more than 25 years of experience in providing strategic solutions that produce measurable results for her clients. Her fresh, inspirational, and humorous book, which we'll talk about again, Oops, I'm the Manager, Getting Past What Do I Do Now in 5 Easy Steps, serves as a valuable resource to people who are suddenly thrown into management and find themselves without the necessary training. She also has another passion, coaching leaders, which we're going to talk about also today, and lives by the old adage, think before you speak. That's something I need to learn. As an extrovert, I find it hard to do that sometimes, but it really does work. Does it really work?
It really does work.
Okay, well then we're going to talk about that. She has a wide range of experience, but most importantly, everybody wants to know her credentials. She's got her master's in science in organization development from Johns Hopkins. She's a certified professional coach, an associate certified coach, and delivers a variety of keynote speeches, writes articles, writes books. Let's get down to it. Kathy, tell us about your background. What made you step out and want to start your own consulting firm?
Well, thanks, Wayne. You know, I spent about 25 years in the commercial sector, and I wanted something that was my own. And so in 1999, I took my last big step, and I became the VP of HR for a small biotech company. We did great, but then there was the bust.
Yeah.
So I decided to go out on my own. So I hung a shingle in 2001, and it's been great ever since.
What are some of the challenges that you're seeing in terms of management in the workplace?
You know, it's the old communication skills. I mean, people that I talk to say to me, Kathy G, it's the soft skills, which kind of pushes my button, because if it was soft, it would be easy, right? So it's not so easy to do the communication, the interpersonal, the relationship management. So when I coach executives or VP leaders, I find that that's kind of the space that I'm in. It's not a technical issue. They're not asking me to coach them because they can't put a strategy together, mm-hmm. or they can't come up with, you know, they can't recruit the best and the brightest. It's about the relationship management, communication, interpersonal skills that I get more calls about.
So how to talk to people.
How to relate to people, how to talk to them, how to use the right words and actions mm-hmm. to motivate people into action.
So communication skills are the weakness that people you see time and time again.
Yeah, you know, you kind of joked about it, saying that you're extroverted, so am I. And sometimes the extrovert does have trouble. They come up with a comment, and as it's coming out, they wish they could pull it back, because then there's like lots of hurt feelings and people's eyes start to roll back in their heads, and they just wish they could stop what they were saying, but it's a little
too late.
But we can't
help it. We just can't help it.
We actually can help it.
Oh, okay.
We actually can help it.
Will you show us how?
I will try.
The Corporate Nanny, which is your trademark, and it's also the name of your book. What is she all about?
You know, she's kind of my alter ego. I love her because I'm able to get into organizations and find the kind of common ground, use some common sense approaches to things, not the big management textbook words, but just the real on the ground, what's going on, and how do we fix it?
Mm-hmm.
And I become a part of their organization. In fact, I was in a meeting not that long ago, and one of the VPs said, so Kathy G, how long have you been with the firm? And I'm like, I've never been with the firm. I'm just a consultant. But I really try to become a part of the cloth so that they kind of relate to me and we can get the issues resolved and move on to the next project.
Do you find that it's a gender thing sometimes, or do you find that it's an age thing? Is it a generational thing? I mean, what are you seeing in the workforce today that causes gaps in the workforce?
You know, I won't use the excuse for age or gender or diversity. I don't use it as an excuse.
Okay.
We don't have a lot of self-management skills. You know, people have to learn how to manage themselves, and people have to learn how to observe other people's behaviors and kind of intuitively know what motivates people into action. So I kind of put a lot of responsibility on my clients to themselves to kind of own their own stuff.
I think, though, I mean, I have 4 children. They're all very different, and they all have different personalities.
Yep.
And what I've noticed is that some, you know, just children and adults as well, some get it. Some get the interpersonal communications and the social skills, and some don't.
Mm-hmm.
Can you teach these people these skills, or is it something that you try to do, or at least cause them to observe it in themselves?
So as a coach, I'm not so much a teacher, but kind of someone who helps pull out the self-awareness from somebody.
Okay.
And so when they come to me and say, here's where the disconnect happened, if I can get them to that point where they can see, rather than saying, I don't know why I'm here, they said, right. I have to see you. You know, like one of those things. I hate those calls, but I have some of those. But if I can get them to see the disconnect, then the self-awareness starts kicking in and right. they can own some of that. Maybe I should have said it this way to kind of tap into them.
When you were on the show about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. It's actually 2.5 years now, but we talked about your book, Oops, I'm the Manager. How's it doing today?
It's been a great experience for me. We sold almost 2,000 copies.
That's wonderful.
Which for me, I was like, thrilled. Most of the sales have been through workshops that I do, speeches that I give. I have a whole supervisory skills workshop for that line manager, that entry-level manager, where we actually talk about how do you experience your self-awareness? How do you find facts? What does respect look like for everyone? How do you use humor without insulting someone? And at the end of the day, we get paid as a supervisor to put it all together. So how does that look? And it's been very well received. I've got 2 hour blocks, 4 hour blocks, 6 hour blocks. So my clients have really pushed me in a lot of different ways. And so the book has a lot of applicability. So it's been fun.
What inspired you to write it?
Well, as early on in my career, I didn't have any training. You know, I was like coming out of the ladies' room one day and they said, hey, you want to be the director? Because this guy just left. And I'm like, okay. And so
take a body filled position.
Exactly. Right. And most of us, you know, my brothers are government guys, right? So they have to apply for jobs and who has to take a test. But most people don't have to apply. There's not a rigor around interviewing unless you maybe are in the government. Sometimes it's just because someone sees you and your boss is freaking out because they don't have a body to fill a spot and they just say, hey, you want it? So that happened to me and I had no help and I had no wingman. So I decided to write about it instead of just letting it just kind of sit out there and people finding their own way.
Well, you've done a great job. I mean, you've got a successful book. You've got workshops that you're conducting. You've got the corporate nanny going mm-hmm. on and now executive coaching. Why mm-hmm. executive coaching?
You know, I subscribe to it's lonely at the top.
And yes, when it really is.
And when I became the VP of HR for my last job, I'll never forget this. My boss at the time said to me, so what am I supposed to do with you? How do I review you? And I realized, wow, it really is lonely at the top. And a lot of my clients are CEOs of big companies. They're EVPs of big companies. And they don't have a lot of people to talk to.
Right.
So it's actually kind of cool for me to be in that space with them so that we can kind of bounce things off of each other and get some ideas going before they go out there and decide to do something that may or may not work.
Right.
So it's been fabulous. I've actually been coaching for about 5 years now and decided to make it legit. So I am a certified professional coach now. And most of my clients come from my existing consulting practice. So it's a really cool way of getting clients.
What do you do as an executive coach? What are some of the functions that you perform for your clients? And who are your best clients?
So my best clients, I'll answer that question first, are the ones who want the help.
That's good.
Yeah, they're the ones that want the help.
Not the ones who are thrust in the room with you and say, go talk to her,
right.
She's going to help
right.
you.
Yeah, right. When I'm walking down the hall of windows and one of the guys say, as long as you're passing my office, Kathy G, that's a good thing. I hate that because it's not about that. But
that's
it's about
right.
the client who wants the help and knows they need some help. And the help could not necessarily be performance related, but just they might be stuck. They might be in a new position. They might be in a transition position. They might say, you know what? I got 2 more years, man, and I want to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be a whole life change position. So it's not about punitive. So they did something wrong. So they have to see Kathy G, the coach. So I like the client who's open to self-awareness, open to some of my wacky assessments that I have and kind of humor me with some of the assessments that I make them take. But it really helps us frame up their goals. So without my knowing where they want to go, it's really hard for me as a coach to help them. So the first thing we do is we set up some goals.
Okay.
And they're set up by the client. I don't set them up. And I, as a coach...
Do you question the goals, though?
No, I question their validity and what they mean to them so that I understand what they are.
Okay.
Because the client has to own what they want to work on.
Right.
And I'll give you a little definition of the difference between coaching and therapy. You know, coaching helps someone get from where they are to where they want to be.
Okay.
And therapy kind of, when you go back into a situation, you're trying to analyze why someone said this or how that happened, and they kind of live in the past. Coaching doesn't live in the past. Coaching lives in the future.
That's why I never really wanted myself to go through therapy, because I don't want to live in the past.
Yeah, a lot of people don't. Some people need that, and I think therapy
maybe to discover why they're behaving a certain way.
Exactly.
Or something.
Yeah. So there's a reason for, you know, clinical therapy sessions and executive coaching sessions. But the executive coaching session is the one moving forward. It's going back and checking out why it happened and then moving forward trying to fix the behavior.
You know, I've talked to a lot of executive coaches. I've had them come on the show before, and I've never heard that analogy or that comparison, rather. And I think it's a great comparison. Mm-hmm. Therapy deals with the past.
Yep.
Coaching is looking to the future.
Yep. Okay. And it really helps. So once we figure out what the goals are, then I've got some, you know, tips up my sleeve and tricks up my sleeve about some assessments we can use. We talk about what the ideal image of a leader is. You know, we kind of get at some of the core issues. I have a cool new energy leadership assessment index that I'm certified in that actually measures attitude. And it talks about perceptions of the mm-hmm. world and perceptions of your leadership capabilities. So because attitudes are subjective and you can change them, it's kind of cool, because once we figure out where they sit on their energy level map, then we can figure out how we can alter that. If do they want to shift their energy, how can they become better people, better leaders?
Outstanding.
So it's actually kind of cool.
So why is executive coaching in such, you know, demand these days? It's in vogue. I know a lot of people are using executive coaches. I've used them in the past.
I think, and I'll not to repeat myself, but I'll go back and say it's that lonely at the top phenomenon. You know, people feel like they want someone they can talk to.
But people have been like that for decades, centuries.
I think they're starting to talk about it's lonely at the top.
Right.
I think years ago when you got in that corner office, you got the office with the windows, you just kind of faked it. Like you made believe you knew what you were doing and hope that your boss knew, or hope that the board knew.
True.
But there's no place to fake it anymore.
Right.
I mean, with the economy the way it is, people coming and going, transitions happening so fast, giant companies buying small companies buying giant companies. You really can't just run and hide anymore. You really have to be in that corner office and have that leadership capability and attitude moving forward. So I feel like the people are starting in those positions, starting to realize, hey, I can't run or hide. I got to figure out what I got to do, because I want to be the CEO in another company. This isn't my last company. And so I think that's the difference.
Do you work mostly with companies that are rather large, or CEOs of large companies, or do you work with entrepreneurs as well?
Most of my clients are large companies, you know,
okay.
$1 billion, $2 billion in sales or revenue. I do a lot of smaller, like 400 employees, kind of that CEO who's ready for that next big step.
Right.
But my sweet spot where I like it to be is in that higher level organizational development capability.
What makes your executive coaching style different from other executive coaches?
So you see that I'm kind of relaxed, right? Even though I'm kind of sitting across from you.
You relaxed?
Thinking, yeah, relaxed.
No, you're like bouncing off the wall in here.
No, I only had one cup of coffee.
Like tying her down to the chair so she won't jump up and down.
I only had one cup of coffee
this morning.
But I am really curious about people, and I'm curious about people's behavior, and I like to kind of understand where they're coming from. So if I could just talk about my playground personalities for a minute, you remember the peacemaker and the organizer and the revolutionary and the steamroller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If I'm working with an organizer, I'm going to make sure they have a list of things to do at the end of our session, because that's what's going to motivate them into action.
If people want to get in touch with you, Kathy G, how do they do that?
So it's www.thecorporatenanny.net or Kathy at kgworks.com. And I'd love to chat and get some coaching going.
Oops, I'm the manager.
That's right.
Thanks for being on the show once again.
Thanks, Wayne. It was fun.
And by the way, listen to Kathy's prior interview by going to our archives on blueprintforwealth.org. All of you, thanks for listening and have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 a.m.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not